Thank you very much, and welcome everyone to CLASP's audio conference, A Flexible Workplace for All Workers. I'm Jody Levin-Epstein. We have over 230 registrants from nearly 40 states. Each of you have probably already heard that it's way too complicated for businesses to consider the scheduling needs of low-wage workers, and that corporate investments in career tracks and in training should be aimed at keeping talent, otherwise known as the top earners. Guess what? There are employers who promote the performance of all employees in order to improve company performance. In this audio conference, you'll hear about some of these best practices, which demonstrate that they are both doable and desirable. And you'll get ideas on actions to change the status quo. I'm going to do very short bios of today's guests, mostly so you can hear their voices. You have links to fuller bios. Jody Hyman has joined us. Hi, Jody.
Hi, everybody.
Her latest book is Profit at the Bottom of the Ladder, Creating Value by Investing in Your Workforce. Her co-author is Magda Barrera. Joan Blades has a new book out and a new website about the custom fit workplace. Choose when, where, and how to work and boost your bottom line. Co-author Nanette Fondas. Hi, Joan. How are you?
Hi there. Hello, all.
I would introduce Joan Williams, who was slated to join us today, but she woke up with what is known in the biz as speaker's nightmare, also known as no voice. We are going to reschedule. She and I have emailed already, so don't worry. We'll be having a chance for you to tune in and talk with Joan about her brand new book, Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. A little bit of a backstory here about what led to this audio call. Earlier in 2010, I had a conversation with Joan Blades, and I learned from her that she was working on this really interesting book about best practices and workplace flexibility and so on, with businesses in mind. And then, a couple weeks later, I'm talking to Jody, and she's telling me about a book she's got underway about best practices with businesses, about workplace flexibility and other sorts of things. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, these two forces in our field are working on these books that are going to lift up best practices and give us some great insights. So I rushed, gotten them together, and I think you guys got a chance to talk way back when, and we started brainstorming this idea for this audio conference. So I'm so glad it all came together, and so glad about the serendipity about knowing that the two of you were working in your own offices, probably thousands of miles apart, and you both have put together, and I have to confess to the audience, I've read both books a couple of times, I've underlined, I've dog-eared the pages. You all are going to really get a lot from reading the full text after you've heard this audio call. So go out and get the books so you too can dog-ear the material. But thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, very much for putting this together.
Terrific. Let's just start with a little bit of background. A first question that one often asks an author, so I'm just going to go ahead and do it, is what led you to write your book? What sort of prompted you? Was there some sort of experience, some sort of meeting you were at? What caused you to sit down, get out there and find out what's happening and take all that time one does in front of the computer to write a book? Jody, if you could take that one first.
Sure. Well, all of us, I think, were reading the stories of companies across the United States that were giving these extraordinary concierge benefits at the top. Stock options worth millions and more, gold label healthcare, and everything you could possibly need to make your life easy. Bring your dry cleaning to work, you name it. And at the same time, it was quite clear that most of the people that many of us work with and many of us do, that's not what they were experiencing at work. Wall Street, meanwhile, was rewarding companies that cut wages in the middle and bottom. Jobs were deteriorating. And there was a seeming argument everywhere I went that this was an economic necessity. So I want the economic necessity, not the concierge benefits at the top, but the economic necessity that we cut wages, limit flexibility, limit leave in the middle and at the bottom. And I just wanted to know whether it was true. It such an important question to all of our daily lives, to figure out whether or not companies really could succeed or not and improve conditions at all levels, bottom, middle, and top. We focused on where they could improve it at the bottom because that's both where people seemed in greatest need, but also where the argument was strong, was being made most vociferously that you couldn't do anything. And we figured if you can improve conditions at the bottom and be profitable, you can improve it at the middle and at every level.
Great. And Joan, what prompted you to take action and write a book?
Well, about 5 years ago, I co-wrote the Motherhood Manifesto with Kristen Ralph Finkbeiner and started an organization called Moms Rising. And the thickest chapter in the Motherhood Manifesto was open, flexible work. And we started Moms Rising because there's profound bias against mothers in hiring, wages, and advancement. Yeah. And it's, you know, the bias against women is there to some extent, but mothers is where it really the rubber hits the road. The last 4 or 5 years, I have had this as part of that bigger mother agenda, which includes public policies that better support families and economic security, but never been able to go deep on the work issue. And it, you know, spoken at management schools here and there, and it, the story just resonates so deeply about making work that fits people's lives. And it turns out that the work practices that are really good for mothers are really good for everyone. And the culture change piece, you know, we've been, Moms Rising, we've been working a lot on the policy changes, you know, paid sick days, paid family leave, child care, you know, that what the public policy structure should be. We also need to start working on this culture change. So this is a business book. This is a book that if you provide your employees with these good work practices, you're going to have a better bottom line, because I truly believe it's going to make a difference.
Let me ask you both for your elevator speech. What is your basic brief takeaway about your book that you hope everybody will associate whenever they think of your book? Jody?
So I can do this between going from the first to the second floor because it's quite straightforward. Companies in profit at the bottom of the ladder didn't succeed in spite of improving conditions for all their workers. They succeeded because of it. This was true in Alabama, L.A., Roxbury, Washington, China, India, South Africa, and from companies with 27 employees to 126,000.
Great. And Joan?
And for me, it's work that fits is a win-win. Everybody needs to be empowered to meet both their work and outside home or whatever responsibilities. And that's something that's going to be good for your business, and it's going to be good for everyone that works for you.
You both are great at these elevator speeches. I hope you never turn the table on me and ask me to do it. I am just really not good at elevator speeches. Thanks a lot. What's a company story? Both of you really have spent a lot of time talking to firms. Jody, you both domestically and internationally. Joan, you here in the United States. Lots of different kinds of firms, lots of different kinds of industries. But could you lift up one of them and tell us the story that was an aha moment for you doing this research, something you hadn't thought of before or something that particularly excited you? Joan, let's start with you.
Well, for me, one of my favorite stories is the story of Southeast Mills, which is in, let's see, I think it's in South Carolina, North Carolina. It's in the Southeast, and they are a high commitment work environment, and specifically a group that does high performance workplaces has been had them transform into a high commitment workplace, and it's been like that for decades. They've got a collaborative model where the, you know, it's a manufacturing plant that does baked goods.
Does what kind of goods?
Baked goods, you know, mixes and things like that.
Okay.
But everybody there feels part of this community, and when they hire people, the people that are on the floor doing the work are part of the hiring team. And that shared commitment means that all these policies I talk about, flexibility and virtual work and on-ramps and all the parts and pieces kind of fit together in that everybody just accommodate. It's a team. If someone has to be out, the rest of the team fills in for them. It's a process where they feel a shared ownership for the success of their products, and it's hugely profitable for the company, and everybody feels well-treated. There's almost no turnover there. It's a place where people are contributing to the company, and they feel like it is theirs.
Huh. Jody, your aha.
So I would say one company that really brings a lot of it together is a company called Great Little Box. It operates both in British Columbia and across the border in Washington, and they do what their name sounds like they do. They make boxes and other packaging and shipping materials. Now, all of our companies improved working conditions, and many of those that was flexibility or leave, and others it was improving wages and compensation. But to me, the aha moment or the really striking moment about them is they really are emblematic of how if you share profit at the bottom, and in fact profit everywhere, you make more money because of it. So how did they do that? Briefly, they do 15% of profits are shared every month, divided equally across all employees. Once a month, they all sit together, hear the finances from the CEO down to the factory line worker, and discuss what can be done better. As a result, they've found a million ways to save money, to produce more efficiently, and at a time when other manufacturers are going out of business, and in fact, in their industry, many are going out of business, they're thriving. So from 2003 to 2010, they bought out six companies. So they have dramatic growth. They're sharing that growth. But instead of this mindset that we have to provide less to employees in order to make a little more, they've figured out by engaging employees, sharing the benefits, how to actually markedly increase their profits and their productivity.
Both of you cover a range of topics related to investing in the workforce and providing a flexible, supportive work environment within your books, but we're not going to be able to cover it all. For example, Jody, you just mentioned wages and compensation. We're not going to be able to drill into those issues. I'm just going to zero in on four topic areas: schedule flexibility, paid leave, employee engagement, and then the fourth topic will be childcare. Now, while I'm zeroing in on these four topics, an overarching point both of you made in your books is that they all interact, and we appreciate that. But we only have an hour or so, so I'm just going to zero in on those. We appreciate that workplaces and workers don't divide into topics. Just a note also for the audience, we're not going to wait until the end for you to have a chance to ask your questions. So email them to me as they occur to you while we're talking about a topic. It's a simple address, audioconference@clasp.org. So start sending in your questions now about schedule flexibility and paid leave. That's our first set of topics. I've actually already got some in here. Thank you very much. You're doing a great job. Keep them coming. Both of you also write about employers who take on the management challenge of ensuring that all employees can have schedules that are responsive to their needs. Tell us about one, what the company did with regard to schedule flexibility and why they did it. Jody?
So Autoliv Australia, this is a company that manufactures automotive safety equipment. They're in a sector, manufacturing, where flexibility has been perceived to be particularly difficult. And yet they had a whole series of flexible policies. You could choose your starting time, 7, 8, 9 o'clock, so that you could adjust it to your children's schools. You could opt for earning slightly less per week and taking more vacation, 4 weeks instead of 2 weeks a year. And you could save up through how you received your salary for a sabbatical. So why did they do this? Now, they did it because in good economic times, they wanted to be the employer of choice. It led to a decrease in their turnover from 15 to 20% a year down to just 3%. But in tough economic times like we're in now was actually when it really paid off for them, because it meant that the production could adapt to what demand was, to new product lines, to where they had to focus. Because the main thing they had to do in order to make all these flexible policies possible was to do cross-training to ensure that if you wanted to be able to pick whether you start at 7, 8, or 9, you could work on different teams in the factory. So you needed to know how to do those different jobs. If you wanted to give people sabbaticals, again, you needed the cross-training. Immense payoff for the company and demonstrating that it was possible to do flexibility in nearly any environment.
And Joan, your company favorite, why they did it and what they did?
One of my favorite companies is Johnson Moving and Storage in Denver. And they're an over 100-year-old company. And it was actually when the owner's wife heard Joan Williams talking that this whole ball got rolling. Yeah, it's a great story. Yeah, she went to one of Joan's lectures, and I'm sorry you guys are not hearing her today because she's that powerful a lecturer. And then he was told he had to go, and he had never thought about how the policies of the company particularly were bad for women and mothers in particular. And, you know, moving and storage company, you got people delivering things, you got people in the office, it's a big company, so it's a lot of different roles. But he started doing the investigation to find out, well, what were his policies? The policies of the company really not good for people that had kids, that had responsibilities? And he found the answer was yes. And he looked for ways to change that. And depending on what your role was, it would change in different ways. Virtual work became possible for a good segment of the company in sales and areas like that. Drivers, of course, can't work virtually, but they were enabled to shift their jobs, to work with each other, to find the right shifts. Because, you know, a lot of companies just say, this is your shift, this is when you do it. But when you actually give the workers the ability to trade with each other and adjust things, they can make it fit each other much better. And it saved them money. It saved them money because the people that went virtual, then they next time they had to build, they didn't have to build as much space. They were able to attract stronger employees because that's an attractor. And their turnover went down. So he's gone around and spoken to the fact that this is really good for business. And with a, you know, a 100-year-old business, you often don't think they can change, but they can. And they can change in ways that really make a huge difference for all the people working there.
And he did also speak on the video in which you accompanied your earlier book that you were mentioning, and he did self-identified as a Republican. So this is clearly not a partisan issue, but a bipartisan issue. We have an illustration of an employer, not a very large employer, I think, right? Joan, how large is his company? Do you know?
Well, I think it's over 100 people and maybe a few hundred. I honestly don't know. I should find out.
So, you know, we have an illustration of a smaller size company, depending upon how you define small, and a Republican leader who is staking out the value of some scheduling flexibility for his team. Now, I have one I've got to ask, even though it's early on in this call. A lot of folks on this call probably have read research, and each of you cite lots and lots of research that demonstrates the virtues of scheduling flexibility. You know, it reduces absenteeism and employee turnover being a really big ticket cost item for employers. Here's the question. If workplace flexibility, including paid leave, is so good for business, why do you think so few employers today offer work flex for all their workers? Joan?
Okay, I've been thinking about this a lot. Manufacturers and a lot of employers have traditional, rigid, authoritarian management structures. And, you know, there are punitive policies for when you don't do something right. And in a lot of ways, workers are treated like children that need close supervision. Changing that orientation is not trivial. You know, allowing workers to adjust their schedules to better fit other responsibilities often costs the employers nothing. But nonetheless, the employers, many resist because they like the discipline of having all their workers arrive at a given time, or they don't like to add complexity to the work schedule, which they can keep in their head in one way. So there's this comfort level with keeping things as they are. And then, you know, you have to trust your workers to allow them to arrange things with each other or to know that when they come in later, they'll stay later. So it's a real transition in how your relationship is with the people that work for you. And it's a very profound change in some respects. And it's taking a risk making that change. Unless you're the CEO, if you're lower down in the hierarchy, you're really sticking your neck out to do this. So I think it takes courage at any level. Change is scary. And that's, you know, one of the key reasons I wrote this book is I think the more we tell these stories of success, the more that leaders and managers are going to be able to bring these stories. And there's now lots of good research and studies to confirm. And that's why I love Jody's book.
All right.
Thank
I love
you.
Your book.
Thank you.
Jody,
it's
a big
great.
Why.
So I think that I'm an optimist about our ability over the coming years to see a sea change in this. I think that there are a number of barriers to it, but I think one of the barriers is managers and executives really being able to see how it works. They need to know how it works. They have a job they have to get done, and they need to be able to know that they can get it done. My hope, by some of the detailed examples in Profit at the Bottom, which are in more detail there than we'll have today, and I think likewise many of the examples in Joan's book, is that these illustrations are ways for executives who are interested in entertaining this idea but aren't convinced yet that it can really work for them on the flexibility side, and I'm going to come to the paid leave in a minute, that when they see some of the practical details about other firms, how they've made it succeed and why, that they'll be willing to take it on and that they will see that as an avenue to the firm success that they need. Now, that's on the flexibility side. The flexibility actually needs to be implemented by the firm. It can only be implemented, and I think there's a chance for a lot of learning from these detailed cases. The separate piece is the paid leave. I actually think paid leave is fairly hard for companies to do without government leading. Long-term leave around the world, it's nearly always paid for, whether it's paid parental leave or paid sick leave, it's nearly always paid for by government. There's a reason you want to share the costs, and otherwise a company that was small and had the chance of having several parental leaves at once or several sick employees would carry a disproportionate burden that year. That's why whether you're in Europe or in Canada or in 177 other countries around the world, that paid parental leave will be by government. Short-term leave, companies can afford to pay, but again, easier when government takes the lead so that there's a level playing field, so that they know everybody in their industry is providing a minimum number of days, for example, for paid sick days. So I do see business as they see how to do it and learning from these examples and being able to take more of a lead there and to see more culture shift in the workplace. I do think it will still leave a critical role for government on the paid leave side.
I was going to sort of skip over the research and tease people into getting your books, which both brilliantly pull together sites and research pieces, but we have a bunch of inquiries here coming into us, and thank you all to the audience for sending in these questions, asking you to cite evidence that flexible work policies are good for the bottom line. So I'd like you each to maybe just, since there is a lot of stuff out there, just give us maybe your favorite piece of research or your favorite finding that you offer up when you're talking to maybe a group of reluctant employers. Joan, can you start?
Well, I'm thinking there's so much at this point. In the book we have, you know, very thick back to it, and the new website. There's a recent IBM piece that has data that people feel the conflict between work and responsibilities at 38 or 39 hours if they have a rigid schedule, and at 57 hours of work in a week if they do not. That's kind of a dramatic difference in feeling overwhelmed by work,
mm-hmm.
work-life
mm-hmm.
conflict point. That's a new study that came out. That's why it came first to mind.
Mm-hmm. And Jody, a favorite for you?
Well, what I would say to the folks writing in is that there's an overwhelming amount of evidence around recruitment and retention. So if you want to know where a lot of the dollar savings come, it's that there's otherwise so much needless turnover in the workplace. And I say needless meaning the employee is otherwise happy at the workplace. The employer is happy. This person has skills. They want to save it. But they have an illness, so they're lost. They have a baby, so they're lost. Huge costs in recruitment and retention, but also in the loss of the skill set. I think what was striking for us in studying the companies is the question has often been raised, are those costs very real at the low-wage end? Because the argument has been maybe there aren't as many skill sets there that take a long time to retrain. And I think the evidence from all the companies that we went to is, in fact, there are lots of skill sets there. There's less formal education, sure, but there's deep knowledge of how the firm works. So if they're manufacturing cookies, they're better at manufacturing and packaging the cookies. A firm I was at in South Africa where there is high unemployment, but so people could be, in theory, readily replaced, but the skill set for sorting out metals was enormous, so costly to the firm to replace. I think the other big area besides recruitment and retention is the notion that firms have to deliver on time a top quality product, and for many there's a big cost to the lack of on-time delivery. Being able to rely on a healthy, committed workforce is an essential piece of that.
For those of you who are just joining, I'm talking today to Jody Hyman about her book, Profit at the Bottom of the Ladder, and Joan Blades about her book, The Custom Fit Workplace. I have a question for you, Joan, which is that in your book, you tackle the special challenges that unions face with regard to getting custom fit flexibility. Could you just highlight one or two for us? We're getting a lot of questions in here right now, and I'd really like to give our audience a chance to have a crack at you as well. So just some tips from that part of your book.
Well, basically, unions give workers added negotiating power, but they also change the dynamics of getting flexibility. So it's key for unions to start thinking about flexibility as one of the things that they're trying to get for their members. Now, if you have something like the nurses' union, they've been very good about that. And there's so many different unions, it's hard to say this is what unions are doing because they're doing many different things. I think these work-life issues are rising in priority for more and more unions and as we see successes. And, of course, Nancy Feierstein's group, the Labor Project for Working Families, is always trying to let unions know about the good things that are going on in this area, which I think is a really deep and wonderful resource.
Let's turn to paid leave. And, Jody, you were speaking earlier about paid leave, both short-term and long-term, and the government role and that has been assumed in many nations around the world. Let's turn to the U.S., though, and ask a hard question of you. You have done seminal work in pulling together the health implications of the failure to have paid leave of different varieties. And advocates around the nation have been using that information, and we seem to not have as much resonance with some policymakers who we think ought to be jumping out of their skin when they hear about the kinds of points you've made in your research about the poor health implications of not having paid leave. Could you fill us in on both what the implications are and why you think we are not seeing policymakers jumping out of the skin, and for whom this is an issue? Who doesn't have paid leave? So I'm asking you a ton in this one question. Could you take it on, though?
So first, who doesn't have it in the United States? So the answer is both that tens of millions of Americans don't have it across every single economic class, but also that the poor are less likely than the middle and the middle less likely than the affluent. So three-quarters of low-income Americans cannot count on paid leave over a five-year period, paid sick leave. About half of middle-income Americans can't reliably count on it. They either have it none of the time or just some of the time. And even when you're looking at the top quarter of Americans, you still see a significant minority who lack paid leave some of the time. So we're way behind. Just to give you a flavor of the rest of the world, 160 countries around the world guarantee paid sick leave, and certainly all of Europe can rely on this. So what's it do for your health? It matters, I think, most importantly, not just to one's own health. That's probably very obvious to people that when they're sick, they do better if they can stay home and care for themselves, if they can get to the doctor, if they can get the medicine they need. It matters to your children's health. Parents who have paid leave, five times as likely to care for their children themselves when they're sick. Those kids likely to get out of the hospital 30% faster if they're seriously ill. Likely to do better with chronic diseases, diabetes, epilepsy, if the parents can take a small amount of leave when they need to care for them. But I think the thing we all forget, and this is part of reaching the whole public as well as policymakers together, is that it matters not just whether you have sick leave yourself to care for your kid when they're sick, but it matters whether the other parents at the child care center do, because if they don't, they'll send their little girl or boy to child care sick. And when they do, your child will get sick. Same with school. If the workers in the nursing home where mom and dad are don't have paid leave, then mom or dad or grandma or grandpa are more than 30% more likely to get a respiratory infection or diarrheal disease. So it matters whether everybody has it. Lastly, the barrier, I was just going to say briefly, I think the barrier has been the economic worry about it. We tried to put that to rest in another recent book, Raising the Global Floor. The statistics are also on the web at www.raisingtheglobalfloor.org. But basically answering the question, do the most competitive countries, countries with low unemployment, have they been able to afford this? And the short answer is yes.
Thank you. And I'm going to remind the audience how to send in questions to audioconference@clasp.org. Right now we're talking about paid leave and workplace flexibility, so send in questions about that, if you will. Jody, in Norway, paid leave benefits are mandated by the government, and the sky isn't falling on the Norwegian economy. Are there lessons there for us?
Yeah, well, they mandate paid leave, and they mandate a living wage, and they mandate a number of things. But how do they make it happen in a way that's economically that they can have the very low unemployment, which they do, and the very high competitiveness rankings by business leaders? The way they manage it is they invest in education, so they have a highly educated workforce. When people lose jobs, they also give them retraining. So they have a very high productivity, high educated workforce. The paid leave contributes to that productivity, and it also contributes to the productivity of the next generation because they're investing in people's children through the paid parental leave and through other investments in early childhood. They are just of one of the countries that we looked at when we examined the countries that were consistently the most economically competitive over a 10-year period, and every single one except for the United States guaranteed paid sick leave. The overwhelming majority guaranteed a month or more. They all guaranteed paid annual leave, paid maternity. What's the lesson? I think the lesson is there is a very strong economic return to investing in the health of your workforce and to investing in the next generation.
We now are going to turn to our audience questions on paid leave and workplace flexibility, and I'm excited that we have a question here from Representative Dembro from the Oregon State Legislature, and I'm going to read his question directly. He asks, if there are states that have initiated flexible workplace policies for state employees, and whether, if so, is there data on how well they have worked? What I would suggest for Representative Dembro, as well as any other listener, is to go to two of our colleague organizations' websites, and I'm going to mention them right now, which is Workplace Flexibility 2010 has a document called Examples of State Flexible Work Arrangements, Laws from the State. So just go there. And another great resource is our colleague, the Sloan Center on Aging and Work, which has a specific site and documentation around flexible work options in state agencies. Great question, two terrific resources. My other question here now is for you, Joan, from Judy Tastin Bell with the Utah Domestic Violence Council, and I'm going to paraphrase. She asks about how to ensure good employee relations if an employer gives workplace flexibility to employees. How can you make sure that workers don't feel that another staff person is taking advantage of the situation? So it's not convincing the employer, it's about working with the employees. Joan, your take.
It's a great point. It's really a work culture change within a work culture. Results-only work environments have been implemented throughout the Best Buy corporate structure. And they do it by division, by segment. They don't do a part results-only work environment, part not, because if you have disparate ways of managing people, then that's very likely to happen. And you really do have to train the management, but also train the workers that this is a new way of managing work. And of course, in the results-only work environment, you're not talking about just flexibility, you're talking about only judging work by what's produced. And there is no keeping track of time. And they, in fact, train people against even, there's a culture of saying, I stayed so late, or I did this or that, and it's like, cut it out, you know, go take off time to go to your kids' play. That's good. We want you to do it. But if you're making that transition, it's going to take people time to get there, and really consciously training to have people adjust to, we are now a company that embraces whatever kind of flexibility it is. It will be something that management will have to shepherd in a very conscious way and watch that things are working well.
Joan, Jody, we have a couple of folks who've written in. For example, Dale Denkenstein from Catholic Charities North Dakota, asking the same kind of question, but from an employer perspective. How can an employer feel comfortable knowing that if it offers workplace flexibility, you know, it can figure out ways to ensure that it will not feel its own employees are abusing that opportunity? What do you suggest people who want to advocate this kind of culture change in the workplace point to for employers to feel comfortable taking this step?
So I'm very sympathetic to employers' concern about this. I run a operation which has 20-some employees, and so in many ways operate as a small firm. I think there are two steps. First, recognize that how hard employees work is always an issue and that this isn't newly introduced by the question of flexibility. So if you want to know one of the biggest culprits in terms of wasting work time, it'd be computers. I'm calling in from Montreal right now. Here it would be in the winter turning on the NHL and seeing the latest hockey game during the day. We all watched, or many of us did, as there was a monitor on CNN turned to unmentionable websites while they were broadcasting. But we don't toss out computers because they're essential to productivity. I think the first step is recognizing that this kind of flexibility is also essential to productivity, and we just have to figure out how to manage it. So then the second step is, how do you manage it? And this really, my response here dovetails right back to what Joan was saying. In the firms we studied, where it was most effectively managed was where teams worked together and were had responsibility for, autonomy for, and were held accountable for results. And the reason it worked there is that employees managed each other. They did allow them the flexibility when they really needed it, but they also made sure that people were not abusing it. So one firm, as an example, Isola in Norway, manufacturing roofing parts, as soon as they put in a team structure where teams were held responsible for outputs, absenteeism actually declined while they continued to have paid leave, 28% in the summer and 39% in the winter.
We now need to turn to our next topic area, which is employee engagement, particularly focusing in on training and careers. Joan, you wrote that custom fit jobs should accommodate workers who take an off-ramp. Workers who have left the workforce for some reason, whether it be child rearing or getting an associate's degree. Have you found employers who make these kinds of accommodations for workers at all wages?
To be perfectly honest, I don't have good examples for you there. I'm only aware of this kind of formal accommodation for non-linear work histories in a growing number of professional settings. But I believe this kind of accommodation is not only expanding there, but needs to expand everywhere. And, yeah, this is an area where the unions can help with their population. And, you know, the fact that there is this huge difference between what a mother makes and a non-mother makes in wages can be attributed in large part to that bias about wanting linear career histories, and creating that consciousness and learning about this is what we're hoping to do. I hope that anyone that's listening to this call and has some good examples for us will send those examples in to the customfitworkplace.org, because we are trying to collect those stories. This is an ongoing project. The book is the start of the project, and now it's an initiative of Moms Rising to really create an ongoing resource and place where we can all learn from each other about this.
Jody, we know that employer training for low-wage workers is limited. Those workers often only get what they need, training for what they need to perform. They're tasks. tell us, though, about the Massachusetts company Dancing Deer, which trains all of its workers about more than the task at hand.
Well, so two simple examples in different industries. One, Dancing Deer Bakery. What's the training it gave? As an example, they gave English language training, something English is a second language with a large immigrant workforce, something that in theory you wouldn't know to work, need to work in a bakery. What's the return to the company? The return to the company was the fact that all of their employees began to work better together, began to communicate better together, and come up with ideas about ways to save money. They also had stock options and profit sharing, so they had incentives to come up with ways to save money. But the combination of the English language and other training with this profit sharing led to it across the Atlantic. Xerox Europe call center provided a virtual learning environment. People could take computerized courses, high school graduates take computerized courses in a range of fields. As a result, about 20% in this call center, and it's a difficult place to work in call centers, got promotions in any given year. And the firm, instead of losing employees left and right, literally, to the companies on their side who were also call centers at a time when Ireland was sort of the call center for Europe, was able to retain its employees. So benefit to the company and this taking the bigger picture clear benefit to the employees.
Great. But even more limited than training for low-wage workers is a shot at employer health with advancement and careers. You know, and Costco seems to be one of those rare firms that provide these opportunities for low-wage workers. Is what they're actually doing hard for other firms? I mean, what is the scoop?
So what they do is an extraordinary amount of promoting within. So 98% of all promotions are within, and even at very high levels. So warehouse managers who might be managing a $100 million a year operation, 68% of them began as hourly workers. It's a deep philosophy of the company. Even if you come in with an advanced degree, they actually want you to start and spend some time as an hourly worker. They reap great benefits from it. The benefits they get is that their top management really understands the operation and is in a much better position to improve operations at the warehouse because so many of them have worked at every level. Plus, they have very low turnover rates, 6% after the first year, because people see it as this rare career track. Is it hard to put in place? I think what it really takes, we've seen companies use different models. The Xerox model I mentioned before, where a large number, 20%, promote in a year, not many making it all the way up to the top, but many making it out of the bottom. And then Costco, where there really is a path very high up into the firm, it mainly takes recognizing that this is both a great draw in who you can recruit, it's a great way to retain people, and it's a way that people are going to understand the business better. So it's really a question of creativity of thought.
John, regarding employee engagement, you've become a fan of high-performance workplaces. You've mentioned it already, but I didn't give you then a chance to really sort of define what it is and what about it excites you that you think is replicable by other kinds of firms. And do you have an illustration of an effort under high-performance workplaces that you can share with the audience today?
Well, what I love about the high-performance workplace is that they're deeply respectful of all workers in the workplaces. And the HPWP training is based upon the belief that 95% of workers just want to do a good job and that managing to catch the 5% that don't want to do a good job, which is the way so much of traditional management goes, undermines that 95%. So the vast majority of every workforce is comprised of responsible people that have families and are trusted members of their community. And it's like it's embracing that and taking advantage of that. And when you treat all your workers like untrustworthy children, you diminish their effectiveness and you undermine your business. So I was fortunate enough to go to a Dr. Pepper training in Texas a month ago and sit down with a group of managers that have gone through the training and love how it's changed their work environment. And one of the managers was sitting there telling me, you know, I used to just see all the guys that reported to me as drivers. And one day I went to church and there was one of my drivers. He was in a suit. His family was there with him. He was a respected member of his community. And what he was saying to me that he got on just a very deep level that everybody he is working with is a valuable member of his community at work and, you know, maybe not appear there, but appear in the world and in life. And that kind of transformation of a workplace turns out to be, you know, absolutely great. You know, we're talking about a manufacturing plant of over 1,000 people, a place which traditionally has shrinkage. Shrinkage is taking things away. And all those things, they just plummet. So their shrinkage just dropped to a tiny fraction of what it was. There was more laughter in the workplace. These guys, I was sitting at the table saying, how did things change? What's happened in the last year and a half? And they've trained over 400 managers, supervisors in this facility. And it's meant that now when there's something that's going wrong, the people on the line will say, this is what needs to get fixed. So everybody is more deeply engaged when treated with that kind of respect. And everybody begins to take ownership of the organization you're working for. And I think that's where we need to be going. That needs to become the norm.
And picking up from what you just said, perhaps we should create a laughter metric, the laughter index, so that we can go around and just measure how many people are laughing and the depth and decide whether we have really great employee engagement and a great place to work. It's a terrific, terrific metric. Jody, we're going to turn to childcare. We only have time for a couple of questions in this arena, but you write about it, as does Joan. So I want to pick up on how you noted that best practice employers that you interviewed identified childcare as an appropriate arena for government. So this was employers saying the job here really needs to be government's job. Did you actually get that from U.S. employers or only internationally? And how do you think we can best capitalize on this? Policy-wise?
So we absolutely got it from U.S. employers. We did get it internationally, but probably more in the U.S. because in a number of the other countries it was already guaranteed by the government. But in no country did employers want to be the provider of child care. And yet, at the same time, here in the United States, they recognized, as they did in other countries, that the availability of child care was core to the ability of men and women in their workplace to do the best job they could and to be there reliably and to have their minds on their work. There are companies that provide it when government fails, but it's a hard thing for them to provide it. That's why they get to recommending government. It's hard for them to pay for it when they're competing with companies. If you're in the U.S., they're competing with Canada, where in Quebec, it's child care is $5 a day or $7 for any family publicly provided. So hard for companies to compete across borders that way, and they don't see it as them being the best provider. How can we capitalize on it? I think it really is a key alliance between policymakers and working families and firms, because it's very much a shared interest that this be publicly provided.
Joan, on child care, you write about a formal Babies at Work program and note that it may be most crucial for lower wage workers. What is this Babies at Work program, and can you fill us in on whether it's being used for lower wage workers?
Formal Babies at Work program just started a few years ago, and it is, I mean, the birth of a child in this country is one of the top causes of a poverty spell. And women that are in low-wage jobs are the least likely to have money set aside so that even if they can take 3 months off, technically they can't because they still have to pay rent and feed the rest of their family. So one incredibly good solution for that is if you are in a job that it's safe, because there are clearly jobs where it wouldn't work, but they're, you know, in jobs with phones, cubicles, clerks in stores that have Babies at Work programs that are formalized, and the baby is just there with them. And in some cases, they get paid 80% as opposed to 100% for the program. But that's, in general, it's just a program that allows a mother to go back to work, and sometimes a father too, though more often a mother. And up until 6 months are crawling, and it's figured out, you know, what happens if the baby does get in a stage when they're crying, what happens when they need to be changed, that you're not giving the baby to other people to take care of, that the baby is indeed your responsibility. And when you have all those parameters laid out, it turns out it works far better than a lot of people expected. People that thought they wouldn't like it find that it actually creates better community, and then you really have a wonderful loyalty that's not only with the parents that have used the program very often, but with the whole organization finding that this was good for them. And this is a startup program, but let's face it, parents have been taking their babies to work with them since the beginning of time. It's really the unusual thing that we said, you can't have your baby with you. And then I could go into a whole story about how in this country only 12% of mothers are breastfeeding for the recommended 6 months exclusively, and that has a lot to do with women not needing to work and not being able to do it, particularly in a low-wage job. Your chances of being able to breastfeed exclusively are tiny, infinitesimal.
I'm going to now turn to our audience questions on this topic area of both employee engagement and child care. First up is a question to you, Jody, from Matthew Munch, who's with the Chicago Workforce Investment Council. He asks, it seems there is little rigorous economic analysis that demonstrates the value, either in profit or shareholder value, of providing training, of limiting hours rather than downsizing during a downturn, et cetera. Are you aware of research that Matt hasn't been able to find?
Well, so limiting hours, for example, there is very strong research showing that in the very high hours, people have less productivity per hour. So just as an example, I'm not aware of any research showing productivity declines when you go from 20 hours a week to 30 or 30 to 40. But when you're going from 50-hour weeks to 60-hour weeks, then productivity starts, or 40 to 50, you are starting to decline in the per hour, and they've, you know, measured this for manufacturing and other things, the per hour productivity declines. A very good case for having reasonable limits on hours. I would think there is a fair amount in the training literature, but it's not a literature that we focused on reviewing, because I must admit I thought it was fairly accepted that training that was specific to the job increased productivity. I'm not aware of literature on training that's not specific to the job.
I have a question here for both of you from Louisa Warren at North Carolina Justice Center. She's actually looked at your books and many of the case studies that you offer, and she notes that they are of large employers. In the arena that we're speaking to now with respect to either the topic of employee engagement or of childcare, can you speak to how your frames apply to small business owners? Louisa asks, quote, specifically, how, with much less access to capital and a tighter bottom line, can small business employers look at flexibility for their employees without going into the red? And I've just switched it to employee engagement. So could you take it away, Jody?
Sure. First, I'm delighted you've looked at the book. Just so folks know, it does have large companies, but it also does have a fair number of small firms. So Dancing Deer, 27 employees, Great Little Box, which I just talked about, would be a mid-sized firm. So there really are all sizes. I think that talking about those two pieces separately, childcare, by and large, I think they would tell you that childcare, healthcare, et cetera, are not affordable to the small and mid-sized, and they particularly want to see a government role to share that, and it's very understandable. How can you really put childcare in place on your own, not affordably? That's when we get the conclusions, I think, for me, is the conclusions around there are critical roles for business and critical roles for the public sector. On the employee engagement, absolutely saw the role in small firms. So we'll just take one very concrete example from Dancing Deer, quite a small firm, but a lot of employee engagement, how they make it operate, as I mentioned, the profit sharing, but also regular meetings about what their financial outcomes are and suggestions from employees about how to save money. So there's nothing, it didn't cost them more being smaller. In fact, they thought profit sharing was something they could better afford as a small firm, and it ended up saving them money in ways like they just emailed me about a case where they changed how they did brownie baking tins, spent $75,000 on new tins, recouped all of that money in 3 months, and after that, everything was profit because they had so much less wastage of brownies, obviously specific to their industry, but solutions that came from employee engagement and led to cost savings at the same time as the profit-sharing benefited employees.
Well, you know, if we could all go to Dancing Deer and lick the spoons that they use for those brownies, I'm sure we could figure out a way that could enhance their profitability as well. I'm afraid we have less than 15 minutes left, and I want to turn to your action plans. What struck me in reading both of your books is that you both offer up a plan of action. You know, you went beyond the research, you gave us the stories, and then you say, okay, now so what? I'd like to give you each a chance to give us a very quick sort of summary overview of the variety of steps you'd suggest. But, you know, my underlying question in all of this is whether or not employers who support these variety of good practices do so because they're born that way or do so because they've heard about the research and the findings. I mean, I am struck in reading books and in talking to different employers myself that when I hear about a place that's great, it often turns out that it wasn't because the firm was experimenting with different things and learned something that helped the bottom line. It seems to me so often that it's because the CEO came to the job believing that this was going to help the bottom line. So I want you to push back on that in the context as well of offering up what it is you see as an action plan. And I want to tell the audience, too, to be sure to send in your questions now as you're hearing these folks speak, because we've got to wrap it up in about 10 minutes. And so type away as you hear them speak. So, Joan, from your call to action, can you give us an overview as well as maybe weave in a reaction or a pushback to my observation?
Okay. Well, I'll start with my pushback to your observation. I had a software company. I was a co-founder of a software company way back when, and if I had known about the Babies at Work program, I know at least one employee that would have been vastly happier. She had the standard 3 months off, and she came back to work, and we all assumed that, you know, we're a big business now. We don't have companies. Now, when we were a small business, we had Babies at Work, because that was the only thing we could do. But we'd become, you know, we had over 150 employees. Well, if I had just known about that, the poor woman came back to work, and it's unnatural to leave your baby at 3 months for a lot of people, and she cried every day. And it was just something everybody figured you have to go through. It's not something everybody has to go through, and it would have been, we could have easily had a Babies at Work program at our old company. It didn't occur to anyone there that, oh, she can just do this. So telling these stories and sharing these best practices can have, you know, a profound impact, because a lot of us do things just because we assume that's the way you're supposed to run a business. And we can learn a lot from others by you know, sharing these stories. And, yeah, we have abundant research and studies that flexibility and virtual work are good for the bottom line now. And other custom fit opportunities are showing huge win-win benefits as well. So the question is, how can we make this a movement that creates broad work culture change? And how do we make work that's respectful of workers' lives the norm, as opposed to the exception, which I'm sorry to say I think it is right now? Nanette and I wrote the book hoping to move us forward in our thinking about work, and Moms Rising has launched the website to go with the book and the custom, and has a whole custom fit initiative in order to contribute to this movement. I'm hoping that everyone on this call will share stories and blog. We have a blog that's up, where we've got some wonderful blogs up already, and we want to have more. And working together, I believe we can dramatically change the shape of work for millions of people in this country and other countries too, and make all our lives better in the process. So that's my action plan.
Okay. And Jody, you have a conclusion called the blueprint. Can you lift up from that elements the audience should hear now?
Happy to, and happy to respond briefly to your pushback and say the following. We had to decide whether to only include company leaders in our book who were who I guess you would phrase born that way. I would phrase you know, had great souls, were angels, and the answer is we purposely didn't. And we had some people say, well, you know, this particular leader, do you realize they have this other problem? And we'd say, yes, we think that's great. They weren't all saints, and they all did it because some of them did it because they thought it was the right thing, but they all did it because they made money from it. And so we were delighted to include, if you look at the footnotes, I won't reveal on the audio conference who were the less saintly, but you'll see it there. You know, this makes money. So what's the blueprint for doing it? On the private sector side, first, understanding who performs the majority of the essential work at your company, or if you're in a nonprofit, at your nonprofit. If it's a law firm, that could be lawyers, but it could also be the paralegals. If it's a call center, it's going to be the people making the calls. And if it's on a factory, it's going to be the people on the factory floor. Two, realizing that the firm's success depends on the quality of work of those who carry out the majority of the labor. Seems straightforward, but that's not where we've been focusing on improving working conditions. That's step three. Their productivity completely depends on them being healthy, adequately rested, well prepared to carry out the tasks they perform. That's the training, and motivated in their work. Four, if they know that they're going to benefit as the firm benefits, they will be more deeply committed, and the firm needs to simultaneously really engage their input. I think that's something you've heard from me and you've heard from Joan as she talked about the high-performance workplace. That's all on the firm side. It's accompanied by recognizing that there is really a public role. We've talked about the public role on the paid leave side. We've talked about the public role on childcare. I'll mention one last public role. Wall Street hasn't been very prescient of late about how to make the economy boom. They also aren't the most productive when they reward cutting wages, cutting benefits, and certain kinds of behavior. Other countries do have triple bottom line reporting, more systematic reporting that allows firms to take these long-term investments and be rewarded for them. In our study, the one thing that we did find is in the United States, far more privately owned companies were doing the right thing than publicly traded, and that's because of how much pressure there is on publicly traded not to. It's something that needs to be addressed.
I want to thank you both for joining us today and sharing all of this information. In closing, I want to let the audience know, because we've gotten a bunch of emails in about how to get the books, the titles of the books, and so forth. These were sent to you in the resources link in your registration package, and we will send them back out to you again, as well as a link to this conference call, which will be posted. If you learned anything in this phone call, we hope you will be sure that your colleagues get to hear it, as well as your networks around in your community, your firm, your state, so the wisdom from these women can be shared widely. Again, I want to thank Jody Hyman. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Jody.
And I want to thank Joan Blades. Thank you very much, Joan.
Thank you very much.
All right, and everybody, have a great day.
Thanks to everybody who joined us.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.